Kamenetsky Brothers Podcast, ESPN LA, Brian Kamenetsky, Andy Kamenetsky. It is Friday, the 21st of April, April 21st. We are in the thick of the first round of the NBA playoffs. We'll talk about that. We have some final reaction, I guess, to Lakers exit interviews coming up, and we're going to give away a statue, Andy. We haven't done that in a while.
We have not given away a statue, but we have a very outside-the-box candidate for a statue.
Very special.
Apropos, too, by the way, given where we are in this franchise's history and moving forward, this is a guy that, quite frankly, needs a statue.
I wonder who it could be.
I wonder, too.
Actually, we know, but we're not telling you. So we have that, and it's the one-year anniversary of Prince's death. So we will be talking a little bit about Prince. We've got an interesting exercise passed along to us from stealing from Bomani Jones. That'll be a lot of fun. We'll do that as closer to the end. But let's start with the NBA playoffs, Andy, because that's where we are right now. And last night, Thursday night, was, I think, the moment where, if he wasn't doing it before, Paul George officially invaded the dreams of every Laker fan around LA. It was the perfect storm. George had a big line, 38 points, 15 rebounds, 9 assists, in a game where the Pacers got up huge and then blew a massive lead in a way that will probably only continue to make him mad after calling out teammates after game 1 and game 2. I don't think it could be possible for Paul George to be any more disgruntled than he was after game 3.
Yeah, if Paul George had felt like he did not have the supporting cast before, and if he felt like he was out on an island by himself before.
And it kind of seemed like he did, Andy.
He definitely feels that way now. And then in the meantime, Brian, beyond the fact that the Pacers look like they are in danger of getting swept by the Cavaliers.
They're going to get swept. At best, it goes 5.
Right. It goes 5.
They
started out this series against Cleveland looking like they might have been capable enough to push Cleveland to a point where Paul George might have been able to convince himself, you know what? Lance Stevenson's back. You know, we may have a little bit more than I thought. Right now, it's looking like
CJ Miles hits the shot that he shouldn't have been taking. Then
right,
we're in a different
but right now they look like a team that is exactly how Paul George imagined them when it comes to their potential. But on top of it,
totally inadequate.
But on top of it, and this again is why Laker fans have to be excited at the prospect of nothing else of Paul George becoming a Laker. Who is the team that people picture him going to? If not the Lakers, if not the Pacers,
it is the Boston Celtics.
Boston Celtics have been garbage. During the playoffs.
Now look, Rajon Rondo is hurt, and I saw that news. Oh, Rondo's out for the game 3. That really. Wait a minute, Rondo's hurt. When did that happen?
He's out indefinitely because of a fractured thumb. He's been playing really well.
The only thing that separates us from the animals.
He should fracture. He should fracture the other thumb. He's been playing phenomenal.
So Rondo won't play, which obviously changes the whole tenor of the series, and maybe this is what allows Boston to scrape through because. I mean, let's not forget, Chicago sucks.
Chicago is very bad.
And but Boston is, the analytics say basically the worst number one seed a conference has seen in a long time. And they were just getting hammered on the boards. But the big point of that, I think what you were getting at, and Zach Lowe was listening to his podcast last night, he made this point too. Boston has been so bad. And their record has been kind of so misleading, and there's stuff going on that these guys know, that they, instead of looking at themselves as one player away, they might look at it and say, if we give up all this stuff for Paul George, we still aren't good enough. And so let's hold on, let's wait, try to figure out others, build a team around, because Paul George will kind of cap us out there, and it won't be good enough.
Yeah,
so maybe Boston is less enthused about going after him this offseason.
Well, but I mean, let's just say Boston takes the opposite lesson. They say, okay, we desperately need to bring in somebody like Paul George.
Right.
If Paul George gets traded for, this is not a team that makes you feel threatened that he'll end up staying.
That's true. There's that.
I mean, so even if Boston somehow ends up with Paul George, the big fear that Laker fans would have, and you and I have talked about this before, the Celtics looked like a team that if George got traded to, and even if they weren't his first choice or second choice at the time.
Right. They're good.
You could picture him being like, all right, you know what? I could get used to this playing with Isaiah Thomas, Andy, playing with Al Horford.
Here. Greatness. That's what they are.
A little forced.
My arrow was on the greatness button.
A little bit forced. I'm just saying it was a little bit forced.
It was. So Andy, we were talking about Rudy Giuliani.
Greatness.
All right.
You know what? That would have been.
Wait, hold on. Let me do this one now.
Shame.
That would have been more random, but less forced. If you crammed in the Giuliani reference, more random, less forced. But anyway, like the Celtics do not seem like a threat for Paul George the way that you could at least conceive them before.
Right. And so
this is going phenomenally
going really well. Andy, we're waiting on the one last thing that we're waiting on, the final key is whether or not Paul George makes this all NBA team. Do voters, and I know this is something we've kind of talked about, do voters give him his $70 million, or don't they?
I got to say, you and I have both wanted to be NBA voters. I would love to be able to vote on this stuff. I get why we're not, but
there are a lot of reasons.
I
get why we're not.
Chief among many, I could see where the people who make these decisions might decide you and I just aren't responsible or serious enough for that. Although, if we actually got the opportunity, we'd take it quite seriously.
I take regular voting seriously.
I do too. Seriously. I vote in the local elections.
We have that one coming up on May 17th or whatever. Yes. That's got literally one thing on it.
I know.
One thing.
I know.
This. I don't want to get too far afield here. That is so ridiculous.
It's so California.
There are too many elections.
It's so California.
Too many elections. I want to vote. I am, you know, post-2016 presidential. I am woke, Andy.
Mm-hmm.
I am never going to blow off another election or whatever and all that stuff. Not that I blew off the last one, but local politics are even more important, really, than national politics. And I admit, I haven't voted in every local election. I am now committed. You got to give me more than one thing on a ballot.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a waste of everyone's time and money.
It's the most California thing ever.
One thing. Although I will say, if you happen to care about this issue, and I think it's something about policing and whatever, vote.
It's civic reviews for police cases.
29 people in the city are going to vote on this thing. So go out and vote if you ever want your vote to count. But anyway.
Swinging it back to Paul George, and for people who aren't aware, if Paul George ends up making the All-NBA team, the extra money that the Pacers can offer Paul George in their efforts to retain him, it's about $70 million extra, something like that.
It's the weird super max clause thing where, but they got to come up with a better way to do it.
They do
you
need to come
up
with
voting on that.
Right. As much as I would love to actually be able to vote on these NBA awards and would take it really seriously, I could not handle the pressure of taking $70 million away from Paul George.
Or giving it to him.
Giving it to him, I could live with.
But you understand that, either way, this is, by the way, is why a lot of ESPN, they won't let their people vote anymore.
Sure. I mean, the giving it to him, I can live with because it ain't my money. And I understand that, you're giving Indiana an edge and re-signing him, and that there certainly are complications and implications that come with that. But that's so much easier than taking it away from him.
I guess that's true.
I mean, look, Brian. If he is anywhere remotely close to third team four, which I think he certainly is in that conversation,
sure.
If I'm a voter, that money breaks the tie for me. I cannot handle the idea of taking that from him.
I'd be willing. The money breaks the tie for me if Paul George is willing to let it break the tie for me. Hey, Paul, how bad do you want the All-NBA thing?
You could work a lot of side deals and still.
But that's
come
a real. But I joke. But that's actually
of
a real possibility.
Of course it is.
Paul George's agent making some back channel phone calls to different writers around, going my understanding is, little Katie wants to go to private school and not state school.
I mean, look,
Paul's willing to help you with that.
I mean, to put this in perspective, look how much media will show up to anything and jump all over whatever free stuff we can
like
get.
Like sandwiches.
Yeah.
Here's sandwiches. A sandwich.
I mean, you and I take bottles of Dasani out of Staples Center every game.
Three at least.
Three at least.
I take at least three bottles.
Because there are water bottles there. They're free, and we take them out.
Practically giving them away.
So
There's
an actual check involved.
I once saw Craig Sager, who was making real money working for TNT at the time, filling his bag with the free beer from the case. I mean, we all do it.
Maybe not that many, but
I mean, I don't know if he literally filled the whole thing, but he was putting in multiple beers. We all take free stuff.
Sure. So the idea that you can actually take something of tangible value, it's a messed up system.
How much would Paul George have to give you?
Probably not as much as he should. Because look, if Paul George gives me enough money that it's worth my while, if I lose my ability to vote and even lose my job,
you're rich.
I probably made more.
A million and a half bucks.
Right, I made more in that payoff and bribe than I'll ever make in this actual career.
Yeah, so that ain't hard. All right, so all of these things are lining up really well for the Lakers, which gets to the next question about this all is, does that make you more or less like, I mean, in theory, it drives down what you have to give up to get him if you want to trade for him. And, you know, you can always roll the dice with, hey, well, I think we can sign him anyway. But it's a lot easier to make that signing if you can give him the big money as opposed to the smaller money. Do you still trade for him this summer? Let's say you got to give up Russell or Ingram and something. Because obviously, you know, and you can't use it to dump contracts. It's not the Carmelo Anthony scenarios.
It feels less urgent. I mean, you still have to consider it because you never know when somebody's going to be happy in their situation. You never know what Indiana
might do next
might
year.
Do. You never know what another team might do. You never know who might trade for him. I mean, remember, Kobe went from demanding to play on Pluto to 4 months later realizing he was on a team that was capable of making the finals, and that was before they got Powell.
Yes.
So a lot can happen, which means there's a lot you can leave to chance.
Right, particularly when there's always the team that has Paul George can give him much more money.
But it does feel less urgent. I will say this. It doesn't feel nearly as threatening as it did 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, all right. So the other big guy out there that I don't think anybody thinks about of him leaving and becoming a free agent, but it's interesting, and it's related to Paul George, is Russell Westbrook. And, you know, he was incredible for three quarters in game two against Houston, and he was god-awful in the fourth quarter, 4 of 18 from the floor, and instantly creates the Westbrook referendum question that divides people up and all that stuff. And look, I love watching him play. I don't think that this season has helped Oklahoma City, who obviously needs help. They obviously need help in terms of surrounding Westbrook with better talent. I don't think the triple-double season, the MVP, I think, like, you think he's going to win the MVP, don't you?
I think he will.
I think he will. The MVP season of Russell Westbrook, I don't think is going to attract people to Oklahoma City in the same way that Paul George, who is a lesser player, I don't think anybody would debate that. Not as good, but much easier to play with.
Yeah.
I think if you're the second star the Lakers would want to attract, it's much easier to say, okay, I can go be me with Paul George than I can go be me with Russell Westbrook.
Yeah, I mean, you and I have had these concerns about Westbrook before, you know, when the talk was, will the Lakers essentially peddle all of their young players, flip them all to OKC for Russell Westbrook? And that was especially after Durant left and everybody expected.
Everybody assumed he'd be gone.
Right. Everybody assumed he'd be gone as opposed to re-upping. Westbrook is not for everybody in the same way that Kobe was not for everybody. And what I think is really interesting, potentially at least, about this scenario with Westbrook and OKC trying to build around him more is, you know, for all the talk of whether people wanted to play with Kobe or not, we never really answered the question, because when Kobe was at his peak and the Lakers were a really good team, a contending team, they never had cap space. So we never knew whether or not free agents really did want to play with Kobe.
Right. And when Kobe was doing closer to what Westbrook is now, where his usage rate was a billion and he was dominating every facet of it and shooting 30 times a game and all that kind of stuff, they weren't in position. You know, that's when they were, you know, 7-8 seeds and whatever, but they still weren't, they weren't there long enough to find out who else, because then they, Bynum developed and they got Powell.
Right. And they were capped out during Kobe's peak years. So we never really answered the question one way or the other. And you know, the tail end post Achilles, yeah, people didn't want to play with Kobe, but that's, the team wasn't very good and you were going to be second fiddle to a guy you were better than.
Right.
The team was still going to revolve around Kobe. That's a bad setup.
Don't you think though, I feel like this Russ, and maybe I'm too far away from the closest thing, again, with the Smush Parker, you know, the team, you know, Kobe was 2 weeks worth of 50-point games and dragging right. this very ordinary team to the playoffs. That was the closest equivalent. Maybe I'm just too far.
No, away it's the closest
to remember the day-to-day of that.
I think that team was
this.
I think OKC's team, current team, is deeper.
Yes.
Kobe had the best second player of everyone. Lamar Odom right. was better than anybody currently on the Thunder.
I feel like this version of Russ is even for fewer people than that version of Kobe.
It may be because
like
the
but you understand what I'm saying? Like,
well, it's because the NBA has changed.
Yeah, you're right.
The NBA has changed a lot.
You're right. You're right. That's it. Because the way Kobe played back then was much more in line with how number one guys play. Now it's much more of the analytics, egalitarian, move the ball around type
which
thing.
Russ where, does. I mean,
well, he averages over 10.
He does. He just does it in a very ball dominant alpha male way.
And this is where
Russ.
And this is where it's hard because on the one hand, it's like, come on, man. Like some of these shots you're taking they're
terrible.
Worse than that.
They're terrible.
And they got to be demoralizing and all these other things and it wasn't working. And so I get this is sort of what got them there. And I get that Russ took a lot of these shots all year long and he made a lot of them. And he's, you know, the big reason that, you know, I thought they could get close to 50 games. I didn't think this was exactly how they could do it. I don't think that this is how you can go forward. You look at it and you say, it ain't right. But then he leaves the floor for 90 seconds and they lose the whole lead. And Oladipo hasn't been good. And I can understand the impulse to say, what's the alternative?
I don't know what it is. I mean, this is how they got there. I mean, the numbers bear it out. They are way better when Russell Westbrook gets a triple-double.
When he gets a triple-double. And when obviously, he's not on the floor, they're catastrophic.
Right. And obviously, all triple-doubles are not created equal, and you can look at the efficiency and all of those and how many shots he took, blah, 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 blah. The bottom line is, generally speaking, the more Russ does, the better they are. Either way, though, Russell Westbrook is the most fascinating playoff player that we've had since LeBron actually deserved some scrutiny. I mean, the last few years, people have scrutinized LeBron. It's been ridiculous. I mean, it's just been petty and stupid. But there was a period where LeBron was under a microscope, and I do think he actually deserved it on some level, even if you acknowledged he was obviously a great player. Russell Westbrook is that guy right now who is so fascinating to watch. He's fascinating to discuss. He's fascinating to figure out what the implications of the way that he play, those implications are.
Everything about it. Because I don't want to be that. I don't want to be that guy. I prefer, aesthetically, the James Harden way. And look, James Harden is plenty ball dominant. It's not like he doesn't. But it's more flowing. It's not as aggressively individualistic in the way that Russ is. Again, even acknowledging he is averaging over 10 assists a game. I get that.
And that Harden is a pretty individualistic player.
Of course.
He really is.
But it is so in your face with Russ. And I don't want to be the guy who reflexively, you know, discounts how amazing his season is, says, you know, focuses only on the bad and not to the expense of it's amazing. Like, you know, Max Kellerman used to say when on our air all the time about Kobe, and it was a great point. Yes, he could be even better. Like, wouldn't it be even greater if Kobe was more of a welcoming teammate, if he had a little bit more of the, you know, sort of LeBron or Magic in him or whatever, and he moved the ball a little bit more and all that? He would be even greater than he is, no question. But what he is already amazing and great. And you don't discount that because you have problems with the smaller percentage. I feel the same way about Westbrook. But what I can't get past is the idea that this doesn't work for them long term. Not because, oh, well, they don't got the roster now, but because I don't think you can get the roster with this guy.
It's a legit question to ask.
I don't think you can do it.
It's a very legit question to ask.
All right, so that's that. And we won't have much more time to talk about Westbrook, I don't think, because I don't think that series is going to last long. But the playoffs will obviously keep a track of as they go along. The Lakers, though, finished their exit interviews earlier, or was it last week they finished?
It was last week.
Last week. But we haven't talked since then. Where do you want to start? You want to start with, I know you were with D'Angelo this week. We also heard a lot of Silicon Valley exec modern babble rabble with Rob Pelinka.
Either or. You know what? You just brought up Pelinka. Let's stay there.
All right. So this, I thought, was one of the most important things that Pelinka said the entire time. This matters. Pelinka was talking about free agents, and you know, for all the, he was talking to everyone. He was talking about the players. He was talking to media, but he was communicating with the rest of the league, and I think this is super important.
I anticipate that there are many stars that understand how unique this Los Angeles Laker platform is, and I am fully convinced that we will have one or more than one come. To put a timetable on it, I can't do that, but I do think that as we engage in conversations with voices of influence, it seems like the current of the river has shifted. And whereas in past years it was, gosh, I don't even know if we're going to get meetings with certain players, you can just feel a current shifting now towards us of excitement of gosh, I think that's going to be a huge destination, whether it's people in the media saying they want to be drafted here now, or whether it's you know, just rumblings you hear about players that want to come to LA. You can feel the current shifting our way again.
Feels a little self-serving, I must say, but really what the Lakers are trying to change this narrative that the LA is a you know, frantic, it's what's the word I'm looking
for? Dysfunctional.
Dysfunctional. Thank you. Jeez, it wasn't even that hard a word to come up with. But like the LA that you, the Lakers organization that you think of when you think of great Lakers teams is back. And he's talking to agents and he's talking to players and he's selling this team like an agent would. His client is the team and no longer an individual player. And to hear him talk about it that aggressively in terms of like, it's changing. People are talking about us differently. If you say things enough times, it can become true.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I attended his introductory press conference and got asked by a lot of people, what did he sound like? Because Rob Pelinka, to this point, was somebody who didn't really talk a lot. Privately or publicly. I mean, you and I have had a few conversations with over the years. They lasted six words.
He's not super chatty.
And my response was always, he sounds like an agent. He sounded like an agent on the dais, spinning narrative, branding, you know, like you said, his client, in this case, the Lakers, the way you want it to be. And we saw with this last election, you know, Donald Trump, whether you like him as president, don't like him as president, he is a master brander. I mean, that is more than anything. Donald Trump is amazing at branding. I think it's probably his biggest success.
All he does.
It's all he does. But the way that branding works is it is a relentless spinning forward of whatever narrative you want in that moment. You know, Donald Trump would say five things in 20 minutes that would all contradict each other. But if you try to sell it, you know, it's like George Costanza once said, it's not a lie if you believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And Rob Pelinka, you know, up there sounding like a guy doing a Kobe system commercial, you know, I mean, sounds like Steve Jobs.
The whole thing was you were wondering how Kobe Bryant is going to be working with the organization now. And the answer is in the image of Rob Pelinka.
Or Rob Pelinka helped craft the image for Kobe. You never know.
Whatever it is, but like
everything
he said from the beginning sounded like a version of Kobe.
Right. It sounded like a Kobe system commercial. It sounded like the movie The Master. He was playing Philip Seymour Hoffman, except there are no Scientology overtones. But that it's that type
Fewer,
of Sven, it's that type of Svengali aura. But if you push it forward enough and you've got charisma, and I think Rob Pelinka does have a certain amount of that, and you can actually start providing tangible examples of why things are actually getting better, then yeah, I think the masses will buy it.
But you have, but
you look to create.
Sell the reality. Sure. You have to create the reality and change it. If you say it enough times, it becomes true. But I mean, the contrast. Yeah, the contrast. Here's Pelinka again talking about the change and selling the change and what's going to be different with this group of the Magic Johnson Pelinka led group.
You never want to just make a trade to say, oh, we need to go make a splash. But everything we want to do is we want to be really, really thoughtful, deliberate, intelligent. And so, as we speak, teams that are out of the playoffs can start to entertain trade discussions. So we have a call to action to make our roster better. We know the ways that can be done. That can be done with the draft lottery. That can be done with trades. It can be done in free agency. We are daily cranking out scenarios of ways we can improve. And then along with that, we know we have to have an accountability system of excellence to grow our young players. And we are already working on putting things in place to help our guys develop. One of the things that we're going to put into place is a wellness coordinator here who's looking at things like guys' sleep habits, their nutrition habits, their lifting regimen, their training, and making sure the efforts are really, really coordinated for the player development. So I think you got to be firing on all cylinders to reach greatness, and we're looking at that every day.
Two things. First of all, how the hell did they not have that before? Second, think about all the stuff you heard in there, the buzzwords, excellence and, the emphasis on preparation and scenarios and all these. Everything Pelinka does, it is thoroughly modern.
Yeah.
All of it is meant to be ultra modern. And the language that he uses will resonate with other agents. It will resonate with other GMs, because this is how the world works now, is an extension of this sort of Silicon Valley management style, the commitment to excellence and preparation and scenarios and analytics and all these other things. They could not be, without being bleeps about it, basically could not be saying any more clearly, we are not the guys who were here before.
It makes sense.
It's what they should do.
What they need to be saying, and hopefully the idea that everybody is on the same page moving forward, whether it is the right page or not, will bear itself out. But previously, Jim Buss and Mitch Kupchak were not on the same page as Jeannie Buss. And beyond whatever organizational problems you think come from that, it was an issue because Jeannie Buss would often undercut Jim and Mitch with her very obvious lack of faith in them. And right now, whether it turns out that faith is in the right place or not, She is in a situation where she believes in Magic Johnson, she believes in Rob Pelinka, she believes in Luke Walton, and that can be a big aid in finally moving the organization in the direction you want it to go. It helps also, too, by the way, that they're not in a bad place.
Oh, yeah, no question.
I mean, they are. Magic and Pelinka may ultimately turn out to be very good at their jobs, but it does help that they are taking over in a much brighter, much easier place to navigate from than Jim and Mitch had the last few years. Hey, even taking into account mistakes that Mitch and Jim made.
So the other thing that I thought was encouraging, we'll see what happens. Obviously, we have no way to know what any of this translates into. He made it clear that they're not going to make a trade just to try to get an All-Star for the All-Star game.
Good.
He also said they're going to be very aggressive in fielding scenarios and talking to people and all these other things. But they're certainly aware of the idea that moves that you don't make are as important as moves that you do. He said at the top of the clip we just heard, you don't want to make trades for the purpose of making a splash. I don't think, and this is where having Magic really helps, the last few years they've done things where you felt like they were trying to win the winter or mm-hmm. win the summer. Mm-hmm. You don't need to win the summer when you've just got Magic Johnson and people are feeling good. Like, Magic can kind of sell the summer no matter what the summer
For a little
entails.
While.
For a little while.
For a little while.
I'm worried.
Four summers from now, Magic cannot win the summer.
I'm going this offseason.
Yes, you are correct about that.
They do not need to do anything because, you know, particularly if they don't keep the pick, there's going to be a lot of problems. Well, geez, how are we going to get a star now? There's going to be a lot of pressure to, quote unquote, do something. Never make trades because you got to do something.
Well, either way, if they make a trade or don't make a trade, you know, the moves they make, the moves they don't, they will all end up centering one way or another around D'Angelo Russell.
Correct.
And D'Angelo ended up having his exit interview about a week or so after everybody else because he was in Louisville with his family after his grandmother's unexpected death. And I thought his exit interview was very interesting, in particular because of some of the questions that I got to ask him about. I really wanted to find out D'Angelo's perspective on leadership because that, to me, is the biggest question that there still is about D'Angelo Russell. I mean, you can debate how good a player you think he'll be, but I think by now it's very difficult to make the case that he's not going to be good. I think if you're saying that he's not going to be a good player, you're not paying enough attention.
If he stays healthy, he's a 12 or 13 year NBA player.
I agree. I mean, and a productive one at that. But
Shelvin Mack has been in this league for like 9 years now.
But you know, the issues of leadership and accountability and maturity, I think those are really the question marks surrounding D'Angelo when it comes to whether or not the organization wants to commit to him or not. And he got asked about that.
I mean, honestly, this is all new, you know, not being necessarily a leader, just really, I would say I've never been in a position where I had to I don't know how to say it. I've always been in a leadership position, but where I had to go be the leader, everything was natural to me, you know. What I said to players, how I came prepared to work, that was all natural to me. It was never, oh, today I have to come this way because everybody's watching me. It was never anything like that. So it's all new, but like I said, I'm ready. I'm excited for it.
Essentially what he's saying is people listened to me before because I was the best player on the team.
Right. Who the hell else were they going to take their cues from? They're going to take it from the guy who looks like he could be in the pros. You know, in his 1 year at Ohio State, he went from being somebody who, by his own admission, expected to be there a couple of years to, you know, a one and done second overall pick. Everybody's going to gravitate towards that guy. He's now in a position where he has to actually earn it, where he's playing up against other professionals who've either been in the league longer than him or look like they could have as much potential as him. And Luke has actually said before that he thinks it's harder for D'Angelo to prove himself along those lines to his age peers as opposed to veterans on the team, even though those guys have been in the league longer. And that, to me, I thought was heartening, you know, depending on what D'Angelo does with that. But it's good to see him, I think, recognize what the issue may be.
Yeah, and it's also, not every 19-year-old, 20, 21-year-old is the same. I mean, these guys all get to this point. Many of them, I should say, at least get there differently. And D'Angelo, his deal is different than Ingram's. His deal is different than Randall's. And, you know, it's different than Karl Anthony Towns and some of these other guys who have been on the radar from the time they were in seventh grade. Russell was late to all this stuff. He was not supposed to be he was not heavily recruited out of high school. He ended up at Ohio State. He was not expected to be a one and done. He was. So he's a little, in terms of the being prepared and groomed to be a pro and an NBA point guard with all the other ancillary stuff that comes with that, that isn't just what are you doing on the floor? It's your body language. It's, you know, how you work a locker room, all that stuff. He wasn't groomed for that in the same way that other guys were. So it's not surprising at all that his learning curve in those areas is not as – he's maybe a little behind there relative certainly to the other stuff. It's not surprised. Doesn't mean I'm not saying he automatically gets to where you want him to go. I'm just saying if you put it all together, it's not surprising he's not there yet.
Well, he actually talked about – I asked D'Angelo, like, beyond what you've learned – that you need to do as far as leadership goes and what you're learning about what leadership means. You know, how much are you just learning as you go as a young NBA player? And he said a ton. I mean, he said, like, basically in his position, you know, young players, and I think it applies to a lot of these guys because, you know, it's a collection of young guys without a lot of tangible veteran leadership around, you're figuring out a lot as you go. And you're figuring out this stuff as you go, with other guys figuring it out as they go, and a coach who is figuring this out as he goes. Luke Walton is a first-year head coach. And that's not an ideal way to learn. It doesn't mean it can't be productive, and it doesn't mean that the overall experience can't be positive and that D'Angelo can't reach the places that you want him to go. But it does mean that I think it could take longer than you might expect in a scenario where there's more just guidance.
I would think so. I mean, it's not been the most stable place to be early. I mean, I don't want to be an apologist for the flaws that he has, but...
Well, I don't think we're not being apologists because we're pointing them out.
But I also don't... I don't get why he's automatically been noted out as... I mean, I get... That's not true. I get why. I don't accept why he's been the guy who... is just been named. Okay, well, if they get Markelle Fultz or Lonzo Ball, well, of course they'll trade D'Angelo. Why? If they want to move a guy, you gotta get rid of Russell if you're gonna get a star. Why? I don't get it, because he's played well. I mean, I love what Ingram did toward the end of the year. D'Angelo Russell is the best player on the team, and it's only because he's played well that people like have the expectations. And, you know, his draft status and all that. If he never showed the promise, then people would already have given up on him more. Like, they wouldn't get so angry when he has one bad game.
Yeah, he has a polarizing nature, and he's got, I think, a polarizing personality. And, you know, in a lot of ways, he's still getting punished for the incident with Nick Young.
No question.
And look, it's up to him to prove people wrong. You know, whether they want to believe that they're wrong or not, it's up to him to provide evidence where I think any rational person would say, okay, it's time to put that in the rearview mirror. But there's a lot on D'Angelo, and whether or not he's dedicated enough to act on it, it does seem like he is aware of what he needs to do. Like, he talked about how, you know, he's starting to realize different things that he needs to do when it comes to being a leader for different guys on the team. And I asked him specifically, what did he mean? And he said, well, I've got specifics. I'm not revealing them to you, but I know what they are.
Assuming, he's thinking about it.
Look, assuming he's not BSing, good enough.
We'll see how this goes. It all starts, really, the first domino here is May 16th, when the Lakers find out whether they get to keep their pick. We have not given away a statue, Andy, in a long time.
It's been a minute.
And we need to solve that problem. And this week, we are giving away a statue, not to a player, but to an owner.
A controversial owner.
A controversial owner. Not Johnny Buss.
Not Janie Buss. She is not controversial at all.
Not Jeannie Buss or Joey Buss or Jesse Buss.
Jim Buss. Jim Buss gets a statue.
Gets a statue because he owns the team and he can authorize that sort of thing, even though he's not really in charge anymore.
So are you saying that if Jim Buss wanted to, he could essentially do the equivalent of when various celebrities purchase their star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame?
Various celebrities purchase their own star when Banana Republic dictators just create statues of themselves in the town square. It's more that. I decree today Jim Buss Day. It's more
now,
that.
Jim Buss's statue, though, is very interesting. I mean, it's actually, on one hand, there have been a lot of screw-ups.
Yep.
There have been a lot
not
of...
Not a popular guy. You generally only put up statues of popular people.
There has been a lot of imaging issues, a lot of PR issues.
Mm-hmm.
There's been the botched coup with Johnny Buss to take over
that
the organization.
Didn't go well. That didn't go well. But it still gets a statue.
Still gets a statue. On the other hand, though, Brian, he was there for two titles. And it is unfair to put everything that is bad for the Lakers, put that all in Jim Buss's lap, and give him no credit whatsoever for his participation with those
even if all he deserves is, well, you didn't screw that up. Okay.
Fine, didn't screw it up. You know, look,
people say he was very instrumental in the drafting of Andrew Bynum.
Right, Andrew Bynum played a role in those two titles. Maybe he was too attached to Andrew Bynum, but nonetheless,
yeah, they moved him. They got Dwight Howard.
They got Dwight Howard.
They traded the guy for Dwight Howard.
Everybody at the time love that deal. I mean, people had spent 3 years clamoring for the Lakers to get Dwight Howard.
And it turns out, now, I don't know if he was thinking of it quite the way, in the right way. He was right about not bringing Phil back.
He may have actually...
He may have saved the Lakers.
Jim, this is actually the strongest case you can make for Jim Buss's statue. Jim Buss was the single strongest force in preventing Phil Jackson, president of basketball operations for the Los Angeles Lakers.
Not because he didn't think Phil would be good at it, but because he hated him.
But you know what? The reason.
It doesn't matter.
The reasons don't matter.
The result is the same, and Phil Jackson is not in charge of the Lakers right now in basketball ops, and I think we can all agree, Andy, that is a good thing because it's not going well in New York.
No. No, I mean, really, Jim Buss.
It would have made our Friday shorter for exit interviews.
Jim Buss played.
There we go.
Jim Buss played a major role in dodging what might have been the most damaging potential bullet for the Lakers of like the last 20 years.
And chalk it up to the pettiness if you
sure,
want.
Sure, whatever.
Fine, who cares? So there's good
and he's also, he has provided us some outstanding comedic material.
So do you want me to go first or you want to go first?
You go first.
All right. There is where I'm doing with Jim Buss is I like to think outside the box. I like to be unique. I'm taking the...
That can go either way.
You can't put the Jim Buss statue near Staples Center.
Oh, I think we can agree. He's not in the plaza either for LA Live.
Not... And I don't mean this because he's not popular enough, because... Or like he's not good enough. He's not worthy of it. It's just not a good thing for public safety. People are going to be defacing it.
Yeah.
They're going to be throwing things at it.
No, it's a bad idea.
They're going to be taking selfies in front, making lewd gestures. Mm-hmm. And it's a bad look. Can't have that all over the Insta. So I'm putting him in El Monte. Specifically, there's, to my understanding, a large LA Metro bus depot. And I'm taking Jim, the statue of Jim, and it will be life size, but kind of lying prostrate under one of those LA Metro buses. Because that is where Jim spent most of his time.
Oh.
Under a bus. And sometimes it was fair. Sometimes it was unfair. Sometimes we put him under the bus. Sometimes fans put him under the bus. Sometimes Jim put himself under the bus. But most of his time over the last 3 or 4 years was spent under a bus. So it'll be him wearing one of those Travis Matthews hats underneath a bus in El Monte.
It's not bad.
It's not bad.
It's not bad.
It's not bad.
My location, Brian, is going to be Van Nuys.
Okay.
Just feels about right. I think when you think about where Jim Buss occupies...
Not because of porn.
No. Oh, no. I'm just saying, I think when you think about Jim Buss's, I guess, sort of place in the LA hierarchy as related to his place in the Lakers hierarchy, yeah. Van Nuys seems about right.
Yeah.
The Valley. Not the best place in the Valley. It's not the worst place in the Valley.
It's not the worst. It's not the best.
I was going to say, it's not the worst, but it's getting there.
It's in the lower part.
It's in the lower part.
And look, it's very dirty. They're trying to redevelop Van Nuys, and there's some nice little pockets of or whatever. But generally speaking, if you say Van Nuys to people, they're going to think pornography.
Well, look, if
they're going to think smog and grime.
If Van Nuys experiences the type of revitalization that downtown LA has enjoyed, or what everybody's predicting Inglewood will enjoy, you move the statue.
Here's how you do it.
You can just move it.
Here's how you know.
Move it to a crappier part of the Valley.
If you go on Craigslist and you're looking for an apartment or something like that, it will often say Encino adjacent.
Right.
That means Van Nuys.
Well, here's actually how you know.
No one ever says Van Nuys adjacent.
I was just going to say, that's how you know. Like, Beverly Wood.
Beverly Wood's a nice neighborhood.
It's a nice neighborhood, but it's not Beverly
it's
Hills.
Not Beverly Hills.
They're trying to convince you that Beverly
it's Beverly Wood. Hills. But you could still... Beverly Wood is a nice enough neighbor that you might say something is Beverly Wood adjacent.
And my statue, it's going to be conceptual because I think we can all agree just Jim Buss getting the statue in and of itself feels a little bit conceptual, a little bit outside the box.
Hey, this whole gimmick that we're doing here.
It's going to be life size, but it's just going to be a hat, a mullet, and a cigarette. And it's just going to be those three things. It's almost like, remember the Shmoo? It's going to be kind of like the Shmoo or Captain Caveman in a hat and a cigarette.
All right. What you're really doing here, Andy, is it's something you see a lot on like the
How do you forget
the
racing
chef.
Form?
The
Yeah.
Well, he doesn't have arms in my version.
You got to listen closer, CJ. This is serious. But like, this is very much like you see on Iron Chef or Top Chef or something, like a deconstructed Jim Buss statue.
Right.
Also, maybe you can stick it in.
You know what? Okay. You know what, CJ? I'll take your suggestion. The racing form will be on the ground in front of him, and he's like staring at it in a way that he wishes he could pick it up, but he can't. Like somehow he gets the cigarette lit in his mouth. Like I guess he's got labor for that.
Maybe it's because of the devastation that the racing form represents.
Or the life he should have led. One or the other. But either way, that's
every
be
day Chaz comes by and lights the cigarette.
But that's all. And you know what? Because he can't speak. He can't let Chaz know, hey, the racing form, could you pick that?
Torture.
Yeah. So that there you go. I guess maybe there should be a statue of Chaz next to him as well.
Yeah.
Or we'll do Chaz's statue another day.
I think Chaz gets a better location than the gym.
Should.
At the very least, Chaz is going to be in a bar or near booze. I mean, that's really all, you know, in one form or another. Chaz, is known for.
Did that save it?
Ah, don't do the show now. Do the show later. Did I say gick, by the way? What was the other word? Gimmick and bit, I think is what I was.
Shtick.
Shtick. It came out gick.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't good.
No.
All right, so Prince died a year ago today, and in honor of that, are going to play, I think, kind of a fun game. We did a little bit this morning on the radio, but we're going to do an expanded version. It is going through Prince albums. We stole this idea from Bomani Jones, specifically you did. And what are the categories? You go with big profile Prince albums, and we're picking the...
Best song.
Best song.
The worst song.
Okay.
The most overrated song, most underrated song. And it should be noted, and I think people who regularly listen know this anyway... Brian and I are major Prince fan. Prince is my all-time favorite artist. When you say worst, it's all relative. And also, too, part of what makes the game fun in the first place is Prince has so few bad songs.
Well, he's not on the good albums.
Right, not on the good albums.
On the wheat. There's some chaff when he was upset with Warner and was releasing literally everything he ever
But when you're talking about the wheat, that's what makes it fun.
Yeah, okay.
Is you got to eliminate one of them.
So where
or
do we
label
start?
It one way.
Start?
Let's start with Purple Rain.
Purple Rain, okay. Best song on Purple Rain?
For me, it's Purple Rain. Purple Rain is maybe the greatest love song I've ever heard. It's up there. It's also, it's got a really interesting backstory that Prince actually set out to write like an anthem theme. Like one of those songs that gets everybody to take out their Bics and, you know, light them up and have the whole, you know, the whole arena singing. Like he was looking to like do his version of Bob Seger. Like, I'm not even kidding. That's what he was looking to do. It's just a gorgeous song.
Let's Go Crazy, When Doves Cry, Purple Rain. You got to pick one. I'll go When Doves Cry. I feel like that's, in terms of, like, a little bit innovative.
It's very innovative. You know, no bass line.
But I just mean in terms of what the song's about, how it's constructed, put together, you know, the content of it, all that. It's Let's Go Crazy is amazing. Purple Rain is amazing. I'm going to go When Doves Cry, though.
Worst.
It's really hard.
This is all relative. I mean, it's a good song. If you had to take out one, Take Me With You, I think is the one you will miss the least. It's pretty. I mean, it's a really pretty song.
It's all right.
It's the one I could do without if I
Some people
have
might
to
point to Computer Blue.
No.
But it's a better...
No, you don't
Computer Blue is a better song.
You don't lose Computer Blue just because of the guitar work at the end. The guitar work is too good. You cannot get rid of that.
Yeah, I would
like
agree
his.
With you.
I mean, he knocks the crap out of the wah-wah pedal.
Underrated.
Underrated is The Beautiful Ones. The Beautiful Ones is so pretty and so emotionally wrenching. And plus, you know, in the Purple Rain, he's singing it laying on his back then pointing at Abilonia, putting her to a choice.
I'm going with Baby, I'm a Star. Looking at this, like just because, I mean, that charted, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it did chart.
I don't think it was the number one, but it charted.
I don't think it was.
But I think when you go through all like the hits from Purple Rain, and you, this would be the one everybody kind of forgets, and it's a great song.
It is a really good
song. It's a great song.
And it's also, too, in Purple Rain, when Prince finally realized that the crowd understood him.
And that was important.
He finally could. the best part.
But then, if you go back through and listen to this album again.
It's so good.
But I'm saying, like, Baby I'm a Star is stickier. Like, if you listen, you go and listen to it, it is stickier than you think. And it is stickier than a lot of other Prince songs that you associate more with being hits. So, Baby I'm a Star.
And then Overrated for me, and I love this song, but I'm choosing Darling Nikki because I think it's overrated for its lewdness. I mean, people talk about it being, you know, the Prince's most out there sexual song. It's not even the most out there of that time. Like, you know, Let's Pretend We're Married, Sister, which is about incest, you know, Soft and Wet, which I don't think I need to explain what it's about. some other songs. It's not even close.
I believe it's about flan.
Darling Nikki is just the one that Tipper Gore heard and freaked her out and wanting to have warning labels. But it's not the Prince at his most lewd.
Can I do Take Me With You as both worst and overrated? Because that was a hit.
It was a hit. I guess you could go there if you want to. Sure.
That feels like a bit of a cop-out, but I'm going to do it anyway. You want to do another one?
Sure. 1999.
Song list. All right. Best song.
Little Red Corvette. Little Red Corvette is one of the most, if not the best, constructed pop songs I've ever heard. Like, just as a work of art creating a pop single, it's perfect.
Yeah, and you forget on this, this is Prince, this is in, you know, back in, this was, when did they
1982.
Put this out? 1982. You could still kind of get away with really long songs.
That yeah.
There are a bunch of 5, 6, 7, 8 minute songs on this album that you kind of forget.
People forget how long 1999 uncut is.
Yeah,
it's like 10 minutes.
It's 6 minutes long.
Okay.
That's long.
It is long.
So Little Red Corvette's the best song on the album.
I agree.
Worst.
Worst is probably Free. Free's it's not a great song. It feels a little trite. I mean, it's not awful, but it's not Prince at his best, I would say.
Underrated.
For
me, Lady Cab Driver is a great
song. Lady Cab Driver is a really good song.
Lady Cab Driver is a great song.
That's an underrated
song. And you never, like, nobody ever, you never hear anybody say Lady Cab Driver.
Not often.
Like, that for me fits for underrated.
I'm going Automatic. I think Automatic is really good. You want to talk about long and experimental.
9 minutes, 28 seconds.
But it's really catchy. It's really, really catchy. Like, my 6-year-old daughter loves that song.
It's a good song.
She loves
it. I just feel like that's not underrated. I feel like it's rated. I think it's appropriately rated.
I guess. I think it's more forgotten, which would make it underrated.
Not as forgotten as Lady Cab Driver.
I would disagree. I actually think Lady Cab Driver is more remembered than Automatic.
You think so?
I don't think Automatic was even released as a single.
Oh.
I could be wrong, but I think Lady Cab Driver is probably more remembered than Automatic. But either way, they're both underrated songs.
I agree.
And most overrated.
For it to be overrated, it's got to be kind of a hit in one form or another, something that people think. 1999 is not overrated. I'm sorry, that is not an overrated song. Little Red Corvette, we already talked about. Delirious isn't overrated. Delirious is awesome.
Delirious is awesome.
And if you rate it as awesome, you're correct. You're not making it. Let's Pretend We're Married is a great song. I'm not sure there is an underrated song on this album.
Yeah, overrated.
Overrated.
My response,
because they're forgotten songs.
My choice is actually going to be 1999. And the reason just become it became so overdone at like New
Y2K,
Year's parties,
right?
And especially with Y2K.
But it's not an overrated song. If you're just looking at it as a song.
You have to pick something. You have to pick something. That's the exercise.
I don't want to.
Well, you have to.
All right. Because, like, International Lover can't be the answer because it's not rated.
Sure. I'm just saying you have to pick something.
All right, fine. I'll go with 1999.
I mean, for that rationale, again, Darling Nikki is not an overrated song. It's an awesome song, but it is overrated for its lewdness.
But it is kind of dirty.
You have to find a way in.
Andy, there was a woman
in
the lobby.
I know what she was up to with the magazine, but still.
Liberating herself.
It's overrated.
Your magazine in a hotel lobby.
It's still... Let's not. I don't think we can get into the lyrics of Sister here or a few other songs.
No.
Still.
But she was doing that.
I get it. Okay. I get it.
Do you want to do another one? Or are you one more album? Or
one more.
Okay.
You choose.
Let's do Sign of the Times.
Okay.
Lots to choose from.
There's a lot. This one was hard. This one was very hard.
So you want to do worst?
Okay, we'll start out with worst. I love how it begins, but by the end of Housequake, I'm kind of over it.
That was my choice, too.
I mean, it's not a bad song. It is not a bad song.
I'll be honest with you,
too.
I don't need 9 minutes of It's Going to Be a Beautiful Night.
Oh, I do.
I love that song, but I feel like nine minutes might be too much.
No. You are wrong. You have not listened to It's Going to Be a Beautiful Night lately enough, if that's the way you think. The way it builds and the way it ends is phenomenal. You could argue it doesn't go long enough. I'm serious. It's that great. But I would say Housequake for worse.
I sometimes forget Forever in My Life.
That's a good song.
It's a good song.
My daughter all of a sudden is into that song.
Maybe I'll swap that out with It's Going to Be a Beautiful Night.
Forever in My Life's pretty.
It is, but I sometimes forget. Housequake, Housequake is a good place to start.
Housequake would be for worse for me. Again, it's all relative.
And then Sign of the Times is not an album with bad songs on it.
Not really, no.
All right, so what's next?
I guess overrated. My choice here is going to be controversial.
All right, go ahead.
Adore. Prince fans love Adore. I think I've always gotten the impression that Adore is among the more popular Prince songs among Prince fanatics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's good, but I've never gotten into it the way other Prince fans have. Like, it's never been one that I've gravitated towards. And I think most Prince fans, like, for example, like Bomani, who, you know, we stole this conceit from, is a major Prince fan, has written about Prince. If you ever want to read good stuff about Prince, find Bomani's stuff. I know Bomani loves Adore, and I think he is not alone among Prince fanatics, and it's never been one that really spoke to me.
Is the Cross overrated? Like, is it rated enough to be overrated? It's one of the more forgotten songs, I think, on the album, and I like it, and I used to really like it. I think that may be overrated. It may be the one
that's... And then,
doesn't do a ton for me.
For me, underrated is I Could Never Take the Place of Your Man.
See, I think that's appropriately rated.
I think
most people dig that one.
I think they should dig it more. I think it's that good.
I think most Prince fans put it in the...
They don't dig it enough, as far as I'm concerned. They're still failing.
I think it is underrated.
It is really good.
It is really good, and it is the build in that one from the beginning to the end to where you end up is... awesome.
I went back and
see, like, the It to me seems like a better version of what Prince was sort of trying to go for in The Cross in terms of how the music builds. There's a build to It.
There's a bigger build in The Cross, actually. There's a much bigger build in The Cross than It. But I mean, it doesn't matter. I went back and forth for underrated between I Could Never Take the Place of Your Man and If I Was Your Girlfriend, and then best song, Sign of the Times. And this is hard. There's a lot of really good songs.
Oh, wait. I moved off the page too early.
I went back and forth on this a lot.
I mean, I Could Never Take the Place of Your Man is amazing. Play in the Sunshine is amazing. I'm going to go with I Could Never Take the Place of Your Man.
I'm actually going to go Starfish and Coffee. It's gorgeous, and the lyrics are so print. Like, nobody else would have come up with those lyrics. And it's just, it's really happy.
It is happy.
But it makes you think. It's just, it's great. I love it. It's unusual. It sounds like nobody else by an artist that sounds like nobody else. Even though he's got influence from everyone.
It's on my list of favorite songs, but it's...
So anyway, it's a fun exercise. And again, the 1 year anniversary of Prince's death, both of us huge, huge Prince fans. And it still, to me, feels weird that Prince is gone.
I would agree.
It feels really, really weird.
And sad. All right. So more playoffs, more Lakers stuff. And I guess we want to play this anniversary game. A ton of people died last year. So do this a lot.
Yeah, we might.
And that's it. We'll see everybody next time.